Hello and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we will be discussing the book The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, the 1960 movie The Time Machine based on the book, and the Futurama episode The Late Philip J. Fry, also loosely based on the book. Hello and welcome to History in Reverse. My name is Caroline. I'm here with my father, Richie.
Hello.
And we're here today talking about The Time Machine, the book, the movie, and the Futurama episode. So we got a lot we're going to do. I think we added in the Futurama episode kind of last minute when we realized there was one that riffed on it. So starting with the Time Machine's a classic, H.G. Wells. Dad, did you look up anything about H.G. Wells?
Yes, so this was an interesting thing. The book was published in 1895, and this was his first science fiction novel.
Oh.
And so at the time, H.G. Wells, well, you can look up his Wikipedia entry, but he apparently was a teacher, and he got married fairly young, and then he ran away with one of his students.
Oh, very, very scandalous. Okay.
And he divorced his first wife and married the student. And he moved to Woking, which is, remember that was the place where War of the Worlds started. And that's where he did his writing. Mm-hmm. And so this was his very first book. I think War of the Worlds was the second, which is like published a year or two later. Mm-hmm. So he was pretty prolific, although the book is not terribly long.
So this was his first science fiction, and then he did War of the Worlds.
Yes.
Wow, can you imagine your first science fiction book and it becomes like a classic staple of science fiction? That's crazy.
Well, what one of our members of our book discussion group, Evelyn, mentioned that he did all kinds of serious writing later on in life, and nobody remembers that. And everybody knows his novels.
Well, at the time, it was kind of novel, right? This concept of a time machine. There wasn't really, as far as I'm aware, there weren't really stories like this before.
Right. The only time traveling stuff that I can remember is like Rip Van Winkle, right? So that's kind of somebody falls asleep and wakes up, you know, 20 years later or some such.
Right. This one being different because there's like an actual machine involved in it. And so it's interesting because nowadays there's so many stories about time machines that it seems kind of, you know, when you read the book, it seems kind of basic, but I guess it kind of is basic because it was like the progenitor story of all these time machine stories.
So the other interesting, well, this was also like beginning of the industrial age, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why machines were kind of, people would tinker with the machines and make clocks and whatnot. And the other thing that sort of comes out a little bit in the book and in the movie, mathematics, people talked about multidimensional spaces beyond three dimensions. And very often they considered time another dimension, right? So as the character of time traveler in both versions says, you know, yeah, we can travel in height and width and length. Why not in time? It's just another dimension, right? So he says he figured it out.
Is time considered another dimension?
Yes.
It is? Okay. I don't know. I'm just a lowly lawyer over here. I don't understand the math and the science. We don't do that where I come from. it's definitely very interesting. So I think the way we're going to do this podcast, because we're talking about so many different things, is we're going to discuss the plot of the book first, then the ways that the movie differed or was the same, and then we'll talk about the Futurama episode as well. So the time machine, how does it start?
So, well, it has kind of an interesting structure that seemed to be very popular in books around that time, which is where the narrator is like a person who attends a party or something. Mm-hmm. And the hero comes in and tells the story, and the narrator writes it down. So in this case, I think in the book, the narrator shows up to dinner. This is, I guess, end of 19th century in England, right? And he shows up, this couple of people who come to this dinner, and they don't have names in the book. They only have like professions, the doctor, the accountant, I forget now.
Yeah, it's like the doctor, the journalist, I think there's a professor, right. And then the time traveler is always, for the whole story, is referred to as the time traveler. Right.
So they show up to dinner and he's late, right? So they're kind of surprised.
Which is kind of funny, actually.
Right. Right, exactly. I think that was on purpose. So yeah. He's late and he all of a sudden comes into the dining room and he's like all disheveled and dirty and says, he says, wait, I'm going to be right back. So he goes upstairs to change and clean up. Then he comes down and sits down and he's like, man, what the hell happened to you? And he says, give me some meat. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Yeah. And he like scarfs down dinner and drinks. And they're like, what is going on with you? What's the deal, man? And he's like, yo, you're never going to believe where I've been.
Yeah. He says, I'm going to tell you the story. You can believe me or not, but this is what happened. So
it reminds me kind of the beginning of Shakespeare's play, Midsummer Night's Dream. I think it's in the opening soliloquy, if I recall. I haven't read the play in years, but the characters are like, you know, this is like, you're going to hear a story and like, maybe it's real. Maybe it's all just a dream. Like, you know, and if you don't like it, then it's just a dream. And it's like, okay, cool.
This reminded me also beginning of Heart of Darkness, which mm-hmm. is like a party of old sailor buddies sitting on a boat floating in London, actually in the Thames. Mm-hmm. And this guy named Marlowe, he says, lights up his pipe, says, let me tell you a story.
Yeah. A lot of stories around that time in the 1800s were written. Frankenstein was the same kind of style with this, like, somebody telling you a story, which is not so popular now, but it's definitely interesting. What I like about that is that there is a narrator, right? And, like, the narrator doesn't give us very much influence into the text, but the influence he does give is always calling the time traveler the time traveler,
right?
Even in the beginning, he doesn't call him anything else, because the narrator is the only one who actually believes he has time traveled. I think that's interesting.
Well, also this kind of structure kind of tells you that the hero survived whatever it is that he's
true.
Going to tell you.
Yeah, exactly, because he's there to tell you. Absolutely, that's true. So basically, the time traveler describes how he time traveled. And he did not go into the past. He doesn't go into the past at all.
Well, so how does he time travel?
So he has this magical machine that he sits in. And it's really cute because it's made of like quartz and like gold.
Well, he made it.
Yeah, he like made this magical machine. And he sits in it. And it has like a seat. And
he calls it a saddle.
Yeah, he does call it a saddle. I like the way they did it in the movie. We'll get there. But it's like got some kind of seat or saddle or whatever. It does not seem to have any kind of roof, though. Like it's not enclosed, which leads to a lot of questions. Right. But it has a variety of dials
and a lever.
And a lever, right. And when you pull the lever, you go forward or backwards, and it can go in either direction.
And so it can also go very fast or slow, right? So depending how much mm-hmm. you press it or whatever, like an accelerator.
Right, exactly. So he goes in the future. And I forget, in the book, he doesn't stop anywhere else in the future. He just goes directly to...
He goes pretty far, yeah. So he doesn't try to predict anything that's going to happen within short-term future.
Right.
So he winds up, he just mentions that, you know, he sees the sun kind of go across the sky so fast that it just forms like a band. Mm-hmm. And for a while, he's inside a mountain, he thinks, because wherever he's standing, his space is covered with rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And then he finally stops the machine a little bit too fast.
Yes.
And he falls off it.
Mm-hmm. And right. He wakes up in a wonderful, beautiful paradise and everything is great.
Well, no. So he lands in front of this sculpture that he calls a Sphinx.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this large Sphinx. Does he say how tall it is? It's pretty big. It's like
three
stories
yeah.
high.
Yeah.
There's, I think that he notices there's like a door or something that leads mm-hmm. to it.
Yeah.
So anyway, so he straightens his time machine. You know, he puts it straight. He takes out the lever so nobody can run the machine, because without it, you can't run it. And he starts hearing voices.
Mm-hmm.
And sounds like people are kind of laughing and being happy or whatever. So he starts wandering around, and what does he find?
He finds the Eloi. They're these little people we don't get too much of a description of what they actually physically look like in the book, from what I recall.
He says they're very small.
He says they're small, they're childlike.
Well, he doesn't find out they're called Eloi for a while because they speak some strange language, right? So he actually manages to... So he starts kind of hanging out with them for a minute, and then he's by a river, right? And then he hears screams or cries or something, and he sees one of the Eloi fell into the river and she's drowning. I guess it was a girl. So he's... And all the other Eloi just think, yeah, whatever.
They're like, YOLO, we don't know what to do. Whoops.
So he, being an English gentleman, jumps in and saves her. So she kind of becomes like his little pet, right? So that's kind of how he describes it. It's like that they're little pets. So he can pick her up and put her on her shoulder, like a child. With her, he goes to this building where they walk in, and there's all this table set up with fruit and all these nice stuff. No meat. They were all vegan or, or fruitarians, maybe.
Yes. And so he's able to get food and stuff from them and sort of start to interact with them.
Right. And it's starting to so he learns bits of the language. He picks it up pretty quickly. He's pretty talented that way, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, because people that many years in the future would speak any kind of language similar to what we speak now. But what's interesting about that part of the book is he starts to, you know, he's a scientist, the time traveler. He starts to hypothesize, and he's thinking, you know, he expected to go in the future and find mankind evolved past violence, past poverty, past starvation, all of these things, and to be at this like higher level. Like he expected them to be at this higher level.
Yeah, be smart and
yeah. And he sort of is like kind of beginning to project that assumption onto the Eloi, and he's sort of assuming they are that, but at the same time he's recognizing like there's a distinct lack of technology. Like there's not he's not seeing anything that's like futuristic kind of stuff, and things kind of seem almost like decay and kind of
not quite that's more in a movie, I think. At least around the place when he first goes, the building that they stay in seems to be just fine. And there's all this gardens with fruit and flowers, so they just run around playing basically. Well, he doesn't talk much about sex, but you know the implication is that they kind of go and have fun that way.
Yeah, he kind of implies that that's happening, but then he also describes them as being children and pet like. So it's a very strange juxtaposition of descriptions. But like, yeah, he's going around and kind of a lot of the time machine in the book is spent of him like walking to and from various places and seeing stuff.
Right. He's kind of exploring the area, and he sees some green building in the distance, right? So he, as he learns a little bit of the language, he entertains the Eloi by lighting matches, right? So this is a 19th century gentleman would always have matches on him because they light up pipes or cigars or whatever. Right? So, and they thought that was hysterical because they didn't know what fire was.
Right.
Apparently.
And then he goes back to check up on his time machine, and uh-oh.
Oh, that's right. He goes back to check on his time machine, and the machine is gone.
Whoops. Whoopsie doodle.
Whoopsie doodle.
Yeah. So the machine is gone, but there are drag marks in the dirt that lead to
he freaks out a bit, but he notices that there's the drag marks in the dirt leading into what seems to be like gates under the Sphinx.
Yeah, I think he calls them panels. Yeah, it's basically like... It was dragged inside that building that was kind of right there, and the doors are closed and he can't get in. So now he's stuck. He's got a problem.
So,
but at least he knows that nobody can make it function because he has the lever in his pocket. So when's the first time he interacts with the Morlocks?
Right. So I think, does he sleep outside and hear some dreams that.
Yeah, so what happens is he realizes that the Eloi are very afraid of the dark, and they all go and sleep like together in like a safe spot, basically. And he doesn't. He just like sleeps outside somewhere. And he feels very uneasy. And I don't know if he sees like a Murloc real quick outside. Like he sees like a flash of one. But he sort of begins to become aware of the fact that there's like some kind of like white fuzzy animal situation happening, and that the Eloi are afraid of these other creatures that are called, is it Morlock or Murloc?
Morlock.
Yeah. Murlocs are monsters from World of Warcraft. So it's a Morlock in Time Machine. And they're afraid of the Morlocks. And through interactions with Weena and talking to the other ones and sort of exploring, he comes to learn that the Morlocks live underground and seem to come out at night. And they're like white, they have like white fur, and they're kind of like more ape-like is kind of how he describes them. Like they're bigger and they don't like the sun.
So he's there a couple of nights. I think his whole stay there is about a little bit a week or so, right? Mm-hmm. So he wants to explore more. So he sees this green building far away that he wants to go and check out, right?
Right.
So he takes Weena with him, and she's happy to kind of go along, and they have to cross some woods, and they get to that building. It's a few miles walking. Mm-hmm. I don't know, he said like 5 miles or something.
He got his daily steps in.
Right. So when they get to that building, it's kind of in disrepair. He realizes this is like an old museum,
mm-hmm.
right? So he starts exploring. There is in some dark corner of the museum, he actually sees a Morlock again.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And the Morlock just sees him and runs away. And then he's looking for some tools that he might want to use to try to pry open this door and get his machine back. So like at one point he finds what looks like a stick of dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It says, oh my God, that's great. I can blow something up. Then he realizes, wait a second, nobody would put real dynamite in the museum. Mm-hmm. It's just a mock-up.
Yeah. But lo and behold, the serendipity button was pressed and he finds more matches. And then he has magically more matches. Yay. There were matches in the museum because obviously that's what you do with matches.
Did he? There are these chimney things. Mm-hmm. That he can climb down into the underworld, mm-hmm. right? And is that does he do that before going to the museum?
I don't remember the order.
I think it's before.
So basically, one of the things is he's trying to figure out how to get his time machine back, and he kind of puts together that the Eloi hadn't taken the machine. He talks to them, and they didn't know what he was talking about. So he figures that the Morlocks had taken it, and so he's sort of exploring ways to get into, you know, into their underground besides just going through the doors under the Sphinx. So he does at one point in time kind of climb down into their abyss.
Right, so there's these like chimney things kind of built into the ground where you can climb down underground. And mm-hmm. and they seem to have been made with like handholds or something so you can climb up and down.
Yeah.
Right, so he goes into one of those and he gets into a tunnel right there. And he kind of, when he feels a Morlock trying to touch him or something, he just lights up a match,
mm-hmm. right?
And that scares him off. So he gets to the end of the tunnel. So he sees this larger room. And that's when he finds that what Morlocks like to eat is not fruit.
What? They're not vegan too? Oh, no.
No. They are meat eaters.
Oh, well, whoopsie doodle.
And what kind of meat? Well, they raise it up on the ground, you know. They call it Eloi.
Yeah.
So that then kind of revises his theory of the situation, right?
Right. So he discovers that the Morlocks are eating the Eloi, which gross. And he
basically has to escape from there because he runs out of matches.
Right. He uses up like all his matches in like one go. He barely gets out.
Right.
And he rehypothesizes kind of what the situation is. He had thought the Eloi were like the overlords, that they were like running the show, and the Murlocs were like some kind of like lesser being or something like that. But he realized then that the Morlocks actually were the ones that were dominant, and the Eloi were kept kind of like cattle, like kind of like you know, bred to be eaten, and aware of that fact.
That's when social commentary comes into play, where he talks, you know, he says the Eloi evolved from aristocrats, you mm-hmm. know, who are kind of lazy and not do anything, and that is dependent on servants. And the servants and laborers, you know, wound up working underground more and more and more, and they produce everything. Aristocrats became so lazy that ultimately they just became cattle for the workers. Right.
Exactly. Exactly. And so like he, in the book, Wells separates them by in terms of social class, that the social classes that right. were so distinct that they actually evolved into separate species, which right. is different from what the movie is like.
Right.
And he has an interesting, I wish I had highlighted the line. I listened to the audiobook, so I couldn't highlight the line. That's why. But he, when he's kind of realizing that, he makes an interesting observation about how the, like the special thing about humans, or like the thing that keeps the species like intelligent, is its need to overcome obstacles. And once mm-hmm. you eliminate those obstacles, you eliminate the need for intelligence, and you can just rely on base instinct. And that's right. what had happened, right. was that the Eloi got into a position where they no longer had to toil, and therefore
so easy to just
they lost. Fruits. Yeah, they lost their intelligence and became just like animals based on instinct, as opposed to animals with an intelligence, which I thought was interesting. It was like a weird little paragraph in the middle of like that section of right. the story.
Well, he was, besides being a bit of a socialist, he was very much a Darwinist. So he was mm-hmm. very proponent, you know, he understood the theory of evolution and kind of was trying to, I guess, apply it here.
Yeah. So
so then after he survives his journey into the underworld, he takes Weena with him and the venture to the museum. That's what you're right. That's where he found the extra matches. Mm-hmm. And he finds like a crowbar to bring with him to mm-hmm. try to open the gate. Mm-hmm. Sadly, they stayed a little bit too late at the museum. Mm-hmm. But it starts to get dark, right? So they had to walk through this very dark woods. And well, guess what comes out after dark?
Oh, no.
Well, I think what happened was they stopped before going through the woods and sat around and had a little fire.
Yeah. So he they're on their way back, and he's like exhausted and she's tired and whatever. So he makes them like a campfire, and he's like, oh, I'm just going to like take a nap real quick. And he knows the Morlocks are in the woods around them. Like they kind of know that they're there, but they won't come anywhere near the fire. So he falls asleep, and he falls asleep for too long, and the fire goes out, and he wakes up and the Morlocks are on them. Right. And then it's like a crazy battle in the woods.
Right. And Weena is lost.
Yeah, he leaves Weena behind. The whole forest catches fire.
Forest catches fire. Yeah, she kind of gets lost somewhere. He winds up being on like a hill where he can fight the Morlocks off. He kills a bunch of them, apparently. Mm-hmm. Because the forest go on fire, the Morlocks kind of scatter away, and he manages to get through it.
Right? Yeah, yeah. But he lost his pet Weena in the process. Poor one out for Weena. So he continues back. And then, let's see, in the book, how does it that he gets the time machine back? When he gets back, are the doors open?
The door is open, right?
Yeah.
And the time machine is right there, right?
Yeah. So I think the implication with that is that the Morlocks basically kind of realized he was more trouble than he was worth and didn't want to keep fighting him. So they opened the doors and let him have it back. That was my interpretation of it. I don't know if that's correct.
That's not the impression I got. He doesn't really explain why the door was open. I mean, they have given an explanation in a movie, right?
Yeah. But anyways, I mean, so I think, because in the book, he's around the Sphinx at night. It's not like the door automatically opens at night or something. So it's...
I think only on like a first night he was there. Later, he wasn't. So when he comes back, it happens to be open. He sees the machine, so he just basically mm-hmm. runs and jumps on it. Mm-hmm. And he has to fight a couple of Morlocks off. He puts in the
lever.
Deliver right,
yeah,
and he just pushes it forward, and he just takes off into the future, into mm-hmm. further future, and now comes your favorite part, right?
And that was my favorite part. So it's really cool because H.G. Wells spends like a considerable amount of time describing a variety of things in the future and kind of going forward and seeing like the end of the world kind of thing,
distant really future, cool.
yeah, and like, you know, the sun getting hotter and bigger, and there's like all this really cool imagery about like the world no longer rotates, so half the planet is dark and there's like a bigger moon. It's like a really, really interesting visuals. But I like the giant crabs. So there's in his distant future, his like time machine ends up being on this like beach, and he stops the time machine. And again, his time machine does not have a roof of any kind, which was poor planning, because he describes having difficulty breathing and the temperature being weird and things like that. But the biggest problem was that he was easily attacked by giant crabs on this beach. And there are giant future crabs.
Fortunately, they're moving slowly, right? So he could see.
So he was able to get away. But there's like, it's interesting. It's like the concept that like, okay, in the far distant future, what kind of creatures will still exist? Like crustaceans, probably. It's a pretty safe bet. They've been around for a really long time. They'll probably continue to be around. And under the right circumstances, they will be giant.
Was there a time where he had like large birds or something as well?
In the book.
He goes through different eras.
Yeah, I don't remember. I just remember the crabs because I was very excited.
That was at the very end, yeah. At the end of time, yeah.
So he goes all the way to the end of time. And then what does he do?
And then he comes back.
And he says, that was fun. I'll go back.
And he's late for dinner. And he tells these guys what happened. Mm-hmm. And he reaches in one of his pockets and there's a flower.
Oh, right. We forgot this detail. So Weena was really, the Eloi generally were really into like giving each other flowers. And Weena would give him flowers and he put them in his pocket. So he brought them back. And actually, H.G. Wells had another really beautiful kind of comment on that, that like, even in this, like human beings always manage to maintain like the ability to show compassion or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. He says it's towards the end of the novel. He says it when he pulls the flowers out of his pocket. Cause it's like, it was a kind gesture. It was like something Weena did not to gain anything, not to, you know, earn his approval or anything, but like just to be nice, just be like, this is my new friend. Here's a flower. And so, yeah, he pulls the flower out of his pocket. And I think that's what convinces the narrator that he really went.
Right. I think there was some implication that one of them was a botanist and he knew a little bit about flowers, so he could tell that it was a strange flower.
Yeah. So they can't identify the flower. And he's like, this is like my only proof. And then somebody kind of like the other guys don't really believe him.
Right.
Our narrator kind of does. And somebody kind of implies that like he should get more proof if like he's really trying to sell the story to them. And he kind of implies that he's going to get more proof.
Right. And then I think the narrator comes back another day for dinner and the time traveler is gone. And I don't know if it's his landlady or his lady, you know, his housekeeper rather tells him that he collected, you know, some cameras and stuff and he was going to go and he disappeared.
And then the narrator tells us that it's been 3 years since the time traveler left and he hasn't come back yet. So, whoops.
Oops, that's how the book ends.
Yeah, so that's how the book, let me just take a look at my notes. My friend, so the joke I told you earlier was not my joke. I stole it from Alexa. So Alexa was the one that made the joke after reading this book. And she said, gives a whole new meaning to the phrase, eat the rich.
Right.
so then the movie is similar, kind of.
So in the movie, the character has a name. His name is George.
This is the 1960s version because there's been other versions. Don't watch the other ones. It's actually a very good movie, even for like it being a 1960s movie. It's very good. So yes, anyway, I'm sorry. You were saying.
Right. So his name is George. And basically the way it starts, it's the same scene. The guys show up for dinner. Mm-hmm. And in this case, this is a beginning of the 20th century, right? So it's like a 1990.
Yeah, I think it takes place on New Year's, I think, of 1899.
Well, it starts like 7 days later, right? Because they meet for every week. They meet for dinner,
right? Yeah.
So they come there, and he's not there, and he's late, naturally. And then he gets into the room all dirty and disheveled and stuff. And then he sits down and eats his dinner. And they ask him, what happened? He says, I'm going to tell you the story, but you're not going to believe me, but here it is. And then they go back to the week before where they had the same dinner and he has the model time machine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he had that in the book too. We didn't talk about that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But yeah, it's the same thing. He had built a teeny miniature model of it, which was the cutest thing. And he tested out in front of them.
And well, he explains them about the dimension of time and this and that. And he says, see, he has a time machine. He presses a button and the thing disappears. Mm-hmm. And he says, where did it go? He says, well, it's still here, but in a different time. And he said, mm-hmm. sure. Yeah. We've seen that before.
Yeah, exactly. And so the movie, very similar overarching plot in the movie. This might shock everyone. In the movie, Weena is sexy. She's the sexy future alien lady. Which is a weird choice.
Before we get to Weena, because the movie was made in 1960s, they could have shown some of the future that was upcoming, right? So So couple of times he stops his machine and goes on his street and look at this store across the street where they're selling clothes for ladies. And you can see the skirts go up and up. He meets his friend, who is not his friend, but his friend's son.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And, I like that aspect of the movie that he stopped throughout the early 1900s and mid 1900s to like see what was up basically. At some point in time, I like this subplot. So he had this friend, David Philby.
Yeah.
Who's basically in the role of the narrator from the book. He's like the one guy that believes him about the time travel thing. They're just best friends, those two guys. They are such good bros. And they, at some point in time when he's in his time machine, the time machine's in his house and the lights go out. And so he stops to see like what's up. And then he realizes the house is kind of in decay or whatever. That's when he goes outside and he runs into the man he thinks first time is he his
runs
friend.
First time I think he runs into Philby, no?
No, he never runs into David. He runs in first into David's son, Jamie, but as an adult. So he runs and he looks just like his father and he's played by the same actor. So they saved on Philby's. The time traveler asks, you know, what's with the house across the street that's like got its lights out now and is boarded up? And Philby's son, Jamie Philby, says, oh, my dad was the one that was left in charge of that house after the man who owned it disappeared. And he would never liquidate because he said someday is going to come back. And if that is not the greatest love story you've ever heard, I don't know what is.
It's timeless.
Exactly. I love this subplot. But
they mention World War One, right? Because he says, aren't you on the front? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's World War Two with the airplanes flying over London.
And he's like, flying machines. Oh.
And then we get to 1960s, which they were trying to predict the future, right? So he goes out and there's Philby as an old guy, I guess Philby's son, who's trying, the sirens go off, and he tells everybody has to go underground to hide from the bombs.
Right.
That's the implication.
It's funny because I don't know if you caught the year that was. So the movie was in 1960. The year of that, like future time, was 1966.
Right.
So it was six years in the future.
This was in the middle of the Cold War. So that was a lot of that kind of stuff was being predicted, like a nuclear war and destruction of the whole Earth and stuff.
Yeah.
And so then that occurs. So there's a war and there's bombing and there's a whole slew of really bad special effects.
They're not that bad. It was at least entertaining. But my favorite was that there's the bombing, like the nuclear bomb or whatever. And then the volcano started erupting.
Right.
And he's kind of narrating it. The time traveler, George, is sort of narrating it the whole time. And he's like, you know, Mother Nature responded to man's destruction with her own destruction.
Right.
Very dramatic. So he ends up, because of the lava, he ends up under a rock.
So he jumps on his machine and just starts going forward. So by going fast through time, he manages to avoid being, you know, burned away or whatever. And eventually he lands in front of the Sphinx.
Yep. And then it's a similar story it's a much more truncated story because he doesn't get to the Sphinx until about 50 minutes into the movie.
Right.
It takes a while for him to get there. And, you know, he meets the Eloi. Weena's drowning in the river.
English.
They speak English. It's very convenient that they, you know, English has lasted all this time. you know, Weena drowns in the river, whatever. I think the biggest difference is that the Eloi aren't children. They're all adults, but they're like young adults.
Yeah, they're like teenagers. So
yeah.
Very pretty.
Yeah, Weena's makeup is just perfect. Her hair is perfect. You know, they're all blonde. They're all like, some of them have like really bad wigs, but those are the background.
The boys had pretty bad haircuts though.
Yeah. Those are wigs. Those are all wigs.
Oh, they're wigs. Yeah.
Yeah. They're just, it's,
I guess they're meant to look the same.
Yeah.
So he clearly sees that they not interested in anything. Like he goes with Weena and sits at like a lunch, I guess, mm-hmm. where they're having the fruit, and he tries to talk to the guys and says, "Sir, I say,"
yes.
and they're just ignoring him.
And he's like, "Don't you want to know things?" And they're like, "Why would we want to know things?"
He says, "Don't you have books?"
So he says, "Yes, they show books." And they show him a library and all the books disintegrate when he touches them, and he's right, so sad. And I also am so sad, big sad. So the interesting thing about this too is he. Again, there's kind of a narration over the movie. He kind of is thinking, this is going to be the advanced race. This is going to be advanced humans. This is, you know, these are the good people. And then he sort of realizes that they're not.
Yeah, he's really disappointed. So he says that they kind of just squandered all that knowledge and everything.
Yeah.
So he's kind of disgusted and he says, "I'm just leaving, bye."
Yeah.
And he storms out and goes to his machine. He gets to the place where it was and
it's gone.
And there's obvious tracks taking it behind the gate.
Yeah.
So, you know, bangs on the door a bit. It's a big, big metal thing and there's nothing he could do. Right. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't quite understand what's going on. And around that time, he sees these shadowy figures, not shadowy, like figures with white hair or something.
Yeah. It's getting towards evening. And so he's starting to see the first couple Morlocks kind of in the woods.
So that's when Weena comes after him, I think.
Yeah.
And at one point, Morlock grabs her and he, you know, fights the Morlock off. I think before when he was, the Morlock appeared somewhere, he was, I guess, meant to be dark. So he lights up a match just to see better. And you can see that he realizes they're afraid of the fire.
Right. He learns that they're afraid of that. So he's able, they grab Weena, but he's able to get her back.
So he gets back and they sit down. He makes a little fire
to
keep the Morlocks away. And the kind of, and Weena says, "Oh, pretty."
And she tries to touch it. Oh, Weena, no, that's not how it works. So then they go to the museum because they don't go underground until later.
Right.
So they go to the museum
right. He wants to find out.
Oh, she mentions something to him about like history. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Where did you hear that?" And she's like, "The talking rings."
The talking rings.
Which was like such a cool little thing in this movie. I love the talking rings. And he's like, "What are you talking about? Show me the talking rings." So they go to a local museum close by. Right. And there's a couple different things in the museum. But there's, I don't know who came up with this idea. This is not in the book, but it's a really cool science fiction idea. It's like a flat table and there's these like silver rings. And when you spin them, like you would spin a coin, they talk. They like play a recording. Right. And I think, Dad, you said it was the equivalent of the science fiction character sitting down and reading a book.
Right, right. But it's in the movie, so it's kind of cool, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, they needed to give us exposition about things, right? So he spins a couple rings and we learn about this like 300-year war that went on,
right?
And like the whole world was decimated and there was very few survivors and
underground.
There's like a group that decides to retreat to the caves and go underground, and then there's a group that decides to stay on the surface. And then he concludes, you know, this is how the Morlocks and the Eloi evolved, which is completely removing the social commentary of the book.
Right.
So now,
the commentary that he makes in the movie is that he's mad at them that they squandered all the knowledge and mm-hmm. stuff like that, right? Then he finds out about the Morlocks, right? He's going to.
You mean about them being underground?
Well, he knows about them being underground, and he sees the you know, the chimneys or the entrances into the mm-hmm. underworld, right? Mm-hmm. And he's planning to go down there, right?
Right. Right. And he's about to go down one because he thinks they took his time. At this point, he's figured out that they took his time machine.
Right.
And he's about to go down one, and then
the siren goes off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So we see actually the shot of the Sphinx, and there's like the siren thingies come out of it, like a metal things that make the noise. And all of a sudden, all the Eloi just kind of stand on attention and start walking towards them.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when he runs towards it too, and he's looking for Weena because she.
Well, he's looking for Weena, but like anybody he asks, they seem to be like in some kind of a trance.
Yeah, right. Which is sort of interesting. And when he gets to the Sphinx, the doors are open,
right?
And the Eloi are walking into the doors, and he, Weena gets inside. He just misses it. The siren stops. Yeah, the siren stops, and the doors close, and all the Eloi on the outside are kind of released from this trance. And that's when they, what's the guy say to him?
All clear. He said, what happened? What's this? And they say, it's okay. It's all clear.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, oh my God, the war ended like so long ago. And you're still doing this. Like,
yeah, you
know, this is kind of the mirroring of the people having to go underground because bombs are going to fall. Mm-hmm. And all clear means there's no more bombs, right?
Right. It was a really interesting little detail. I like that a lot.
Well, that's for 1960s.
Yeah. And so George is like, you know, well, what about the people that are inside? Like, when, like, how did we get them or whatever? And the Eloi outside are like, oh, no, they never come back. And George is like, they shall come back. I shall save them. So he goes to the chimney.
And he goes down. Mm-hmm. And it's convenient, like, when he gets to the bottom, he finds a piece of wood and some stuff to wrap around it to make a torch.
He pressed the serendipity button and he found a torch.
Right. I mean, he didn't light it. So he's just kind of going there, and there's then whole underground scene with the Morlocks, and you can see he sees a dining room with the bones scattered all over. Just, yeah. Oh my God, that's what they did with the Eloi.
The music is so dramatic. He looks at it and his face is like horrified, and the music's like da da da, and there's just bones. He's like, then I realize they eat them.
And again, this is the land of very bad special effects.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever watched Batman TV show.
Mm-hmm. A long time ago, yeah.
Yeah, it's that kind of special effects, that quality.
Yeah. You know,
the purple, the Morlocks are purple with like these white hair, the kind of big. And there's these machines kind of sort of doing something or other.
But the thing that's weird about it is, so in the books, when he goes underground, it's dark. It's like pitch black. And one of the reasons that the Morlocks won't come out during the day, and they're afraid of fire, because it's bright, like that's the in the books. And the movie, they also don't come out during the day, and they're also afraid of fire, but then their underground homes are very well lit and you could see everything fine. So I was just kind of like, I was wondering when I was watching the movie, I'm like, how are they going to do the underground parts? Cause it's so dark. And what they did was they just didn't make it dark.
And well, otherwise it would be kind of boring.
Well, I guess.
Just screams.
Yeah. So basically, a long battle scene ensues. He finds the Eloi that were taken, and he finds Weena. He saves them ultimately.
And he also tries to get them to fight as well.
Yeah, so he reintroduces violence to the human race. Thank you, George. He beats up the Morlocks himself. He uses the torch and stuff like that. And then he encourages the Eloi to join. And eventually they do.
And they set the whole place on fire.
And they set the whole place on fire. I'm like, that is just rude. That is just not nice. Like, come on. That's
and like the whole underground kind of collapses. But then the door opens again, and there's his time machine.
And he runs to it.
He was going to get Weena with him. But as he runs past the door, he turns around to get Weena, and the door snaps closed again.
Right.
And there's a whole bunch of Morlocks trying to get him.
Mm-hmm.
So he fights him off, jumps onto the machine, and again goes forward in time. Mm-hmm. And you can see the Morlock that he knocked off, how he deteriorates.
Decaying, yeah. And then I thought we were going to go into the future and see crabs, but we stopped at that point. We went backwards.
Yeah, he says, oh, oops, I'm going the wrong direction.
Yeah. So then he goes back in time. And then the ending of the movie is very similar, where he has a flower and he jumps back into the future. Except the implication in
so what happens is like is when different. When he comes back, right? In the beginning, that the time machine was in his workshop,
mm-hmm.
right? But when he comes back, it's in his garden.
Right, because it had been moved.
Because the Morlocks moved it. So he moves it back into, well, I mean, he goes, tells him the story. He moves it back into his workshop. So the dinner is finished and the people are leaving in, and the doctors and the journalists saying, yeah. That's a very nice story. Philby's kind of hanging around saying, you know, George, you know, take it easy, you know, you'll be fine, you know. And he leaves and he decides to like come back 10 minutes later or something.
Yeah.
And he comes back and he hears some noises from the lab. And the machine, he breaks into the lab with the housekeeper and the machine is no longer there. And he looks at the tracks on the ground and he says, oh, I get it. You know, the machine was inside the Sphinx, but this is where we now are standing. So he moved the machine. Back. So and he went back.
Yeah.
And he took some books with him.
Well, also they made it very clear he went back to be with Weena.
Right.
His one true love.
Right. Well, he wanted to, you know, restart the human civilization without Morlocks, right?
And yeah, so they said that he's going back to rebuild the future and, you know, help them and save Weena and everything like that. And yeah, he doesn't take anything except he takes three books, but they never say what books he takes. I guess that's the question for us as the viewer.
What kind of books would... And also he leaves a note or something, right? No, he writes a note for the people who are going to come to dinner a week later,
right,
saying, you know, if I'm late, just wait, just start eating.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah. I don't know what three books he took because the bookshelf he took them from, those books look like an encyclopedia set. So I'm like, did you take three random books out of an encyclopedia set? Or did we not think this through very deeply in the props department? You know, I don't know exactly what it was. I mean, a man of that time would probably take like the Bible.
Probably take like, you know, Newton's physics or some math books. I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, even a scientist at that time would probably have taken the Bible. I imagine. I mean, maybe he took like, you know,
he could always come back, pick up some more books. I mean,
exactly. It's like, whatever. He has all the time in the world.
start like, and that was the last line, right?
Yeah.
Of the movie, wasn't it?
So I liked that. I liked the visuals of the movie. And so let's talk about like the differences between the two. What was interesting to me is that the themes from the book are kind of lost in the movie, because the themes from the book are like this social commentary about the classes and why classism is bad and how kind of the futility of all of this, given, you know, seeing the future and seeing the, you know, the end of the universe, more or less. The far distant future, and how like all of these, like that in juxtaposition to like class warfare is just, it seems so petty in comparison.
Well, because you have to think about historically in 1895, that was before World Wars, right? Mm-hmm. So World War One turned out to be a horrendous disaster, much, much, much worse than anybody ever thought it might be. Mm-hmm. And World War Two was equally bad. And then for the Cold War, everybody expected World War III to be even worse.
Right.
Right. So that was kind of a big thing.
Well, so it's sort of interesting how like the book had like these themes about like classism, basically. And then the movie being produced in the 1960s, more or less put those themes aside and like didn't apply those themes, but applied the modern concerns of a 1960s audience, which would be, you know, the destructive power of warfare.
Right.
And how warfare was bad. That was definitely a big theme in the movie. But then that makes me question, what's the point of the ending of the movie where he teaches them to be violent again?
Well, there was violence there, just you didn't see it because it was underground, just because Morlock just killed them and ate them. You know, they wanted to be free and
But did they want to be? But the Eloi didn't express any desire to be free, or to even know they weren't.
They'll be free or else.
But also, it's like that's not warfare. That's like agriculture. Like the Morlocks were just raising
cattle
that could talk, right?
You could look at it. You know, the Eloi kind of lived in paradise, right? Mm-hmm. And had no knowledge. And then, you know, you eat your fruit from the tree of knowledge, and all mm-hmm. of a sudden you have to toil and work, as opposed to Morlocks doing that stuff for you.
Right. And so it's like, I guess that's kind of, I don't know that I quite get if there was like a lesson the movie was trying to teach us. Because I thought during the movie, the lesson was war is bad, which is a perfectly good, fine lesson. War is mm-hmm. bad. And seeing it in that scale that he saw it over time gets to that. But the ending doesn't, I mean, unless maybe the implication of the ending is with his knowledge of the history, he's going to try to create a world where that doesn't happen again.
Right. But also it implied that Morlocks were like cattle. They were not free humans. They should be, not Morlocks, the Eloi were not really free. They were just not true humans, not living up to their potential, right? So they needed mm-hmm. freedom and independence of anything so they could pursue knowledge and do things.
Why couldn't the Morlocks be the ones to pursue knowledge? They were already pursuing knowledge and doing things. Just because they were ugly and blue? Like, that's why.
That's my point, you know. I said that about the orcs.
Yeah, exactly.
The hobbits just sat around smoking, you know, pipes, basically, mm-hmm. and orcs did all the work.
So I think it's definitely interesting. It was like a movie that modernized an old story, and
they kept it. At least the beginning of it was kept in the spirit of H.G. Wells, very kind of steampunk, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. No, I mean, like, they kept the science fiction framework that was given to them, but it definitely was designed for a 1960s kind of audience. Because watching it now as a 2022 audience, I still appreciate the aspects of it that are from the time machine, but the other stuff doesn't land as much because, you know, we're not in that same mindset that post World War One, World War Two.
No, this was more of the you know, smart white man comes and teaches the natives the ways of civilization.
Yes, right? He needs to teach them how to be civilized. Yep. It was okay, though, because the people, the Eloi in the movie, were all white, so it didn't have the bad racial implication, but it didn't necessarily implication.
That's a typical colonist, right? I mean, England was a big empire mm-hmm. at the time. Do you want to talk about Futurama a little bit?
Can I talk a little bit about or more about themes first?
Yes, of course.
I felt that the movie kind of had a theme that you and I had touched on, have touched on in the past with several stories, which is this concept of like time travel and fate and like whether or not you can change things in the future or if you're just like accepting of your fate to the extent that there's a little bit of a time loop in the movie because so time travel goes into the near future when he finds out that in the near future, like 30 years later, he had not returned.
Right.
And at the end of the movie, he disappears.
Right.
And I think that implication is that he doesn't return. He goes and he doesn't return. And the fact that him having visited that future where he didn't return and ultimately choosing to go back and time travel again, you know, knowing that he must have time traveled again for that to happen. That's kind of like one of those accepting fate kind of things, like knowing your fate and going with it. And I also wonder to what extent his story affects his friend David Philby, because his story included how David Philby dies.
Right. Right?
So, you know, if Philby believes, then Philby would theoretically be able to stop himself from dying, like not go to the front lines when he's summoned or whatever, you know, theoretically.
Yeah, but Philby didn't know about that part, right? So, well, I guess in the movie.
No, he told the story, and that was in the story that he ran into Philby's son, Jamie, and what they said. But then you get things like the fact that, like, David Philby keeps the house, that then after the house is destroyed, one of the times he visits, there's like a school there or whatever, and there's a plaque that's like, this space is dedicated from David Philby to his friend, his good friend George or whatever. Right. Again, the greatest love story. so like those aspects of the story were told to Philby by the time traveler. So it does kind of create a time. There is like a bit of a time loop in the movie that's like not really explored.
Right.
But I think that kind of goes along with themes we've seen before about, you know, accepting fate and not necessarily, like, they don't take any steps to actively change that future. The time traveler is going to try to help the Eloi, but he's not doing anything to change. Like, he's not doing anything, for example, to change the wars that are going to come. Like, he knows all these wars are going to happen. He's got a time machine. Why can't he figure out, you know, why didn't he go kill Hitler, right? Everyone with a time machine. Why didn't he go kill Hitler? So he doesn't do any of that. He kind of accepts that that's the way it's going to happen to return to the Eloi. So I don't know. I thought that that was kind of interesting in the present, in the movie.
Right. I think you're overthinking it because it's a movie. But yes.
Are you suggesting I'm overanalyzing something? I am shocked. I've never been accused of such a thing.
So I should mention, right, so if you want to actually find out what really happens, you should read the sequel to a time machine called Time Ships, which is written by Stephen Baxter, who's a physicist and who certainly believes in multiple timelines. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of crazy timeline stuff that happens in Time Ships. So if you want to read it.
I tend to think in the book, I'm back and forth on what I think happens in the book. I think he probably dies because of the fact that he doesn't come back. I think because like in the movie, he has a reason to go into the future and stay there because he's like got this emotional connection to Weena for some reason. And he doesn't have that in the book. He has a desire to prove that he is actually time traveling in the book. So he has a reason to go to the future, get data, and come back. The fact that he doesn't makes me think that he died. I think that's the implication. That he died somewhere in the future.
Well, he came back, you know, the guy says in 3 years he hasn't come back, but maybe he comes back in the fourth year.
But why would he do that?
His machine is miscalibrated.
Why would he do? Why would he not just come back the same day? You know, it's I don't know. Anyway, so you want to talk about the Futurama episode?
The Futurama episode, what was called the late...
The late Philip J. Fry, and it's in season 7.
And that one, just Fry has to go to have dinner with Leela for her birthday, and he always is late, always misses everything. So before he goes, the professor says, oh, I just built this cool time machine. Can we just try it? We go up in time for like 1 minute, mm-hmm. and just to test it out.
But it only goes forward. The time machine only goes forward.
This machine only goes forwards in time. And it kind of looks a little bit like the time machine from the time machine in the movie, right?
It's kind
of very
steampunky. The lever in the movie has like a crystal on the end, like a crystal thing. And so does the one in Futurama, which I thought was very cute.
except this one is enclosed, right?
So this one has a roof. Yeah, it's much better designed. Yeah.
So Professor Fry and Bender step into the machine, and one of them slips, and they push the lever way, way too fast.
Yes. And they go into the future. Whoops. And Fry misses his date with Leela. Whoops.
And they're saying, well, we'll go in the future until somebody discovers backwards time machine, and then we'll go back. And they did manage to get to the time where it's kind of funny because like they visit different kinds of science fiction movies. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
Like Terminator, where Bender wanted to stay with all the robots in control. There's some Star Trek-y kind of things.
There's one that's a riff on the time machine, the Wheeze and the Dumlocks. Did you catch that?
Makes sense.
Yeah, so they stop and there's these little aliens with the big ears, and they're like, oh, we don't know we don't know backwards time travel yet, but in about five, if we put our brains to it, like in about 5 years, our society will certainly have unlocked that mystery. And they say, okay, we'll see you in 5 years. And they go forward 5 years and they come back, and the Dumlocks, as they were called in Futurama, have eaten all the Wheeze. So that was their time machine reference. But yeah, they go through different
so they finally get to an era where there's all these beautiful women running around, mm-hmm. and they had invented backwards time machine. But before they can do something, somebody trips over and pushes the lever too far.
Yes. And they go further into the future. And then they get to like when the Earth is dead and there's no life on the Earth anymore. And they're going to say,
well, let's just see the end of the universe and what the hell, and enjoy it. And they do that, and they realize at the end of the universe, new Big Bang happens, mm-hmm. and they wind up to come back to the universe that kind of the universe replaced itself. It's like a huge time loop. So they try to stop at the right spot and they miss again. So they go around again.
They come around a second time. And then, wait, it's great though, because then when they come around and finally stop at the right time, their time ship, which had been on the floor of the laboratory, is now like 10 feet up. Right. And it's floating over where their previous selves were. And the professor goes, oh no, this timeline is 10 feet lower than the last one. And then their ship drops and kills their previous selves. Right. And he's like, oh good, we solved that time paradox. This is great. And then Fry makes his date with Leela.
And actually she left him a message in the
Green
Grotto or whatever it is.
Yeah, the stalactites. So it's like a restaurant. Yeah. The restaurant they're supposed to meet at. She figures out that he's lost in time, basically, in like one of the timelines. And she carves
She finds his birthday card that he recorded for her.
Right. And she's able to leave him a message in stone, basically, for him to find in the future, which he does find. So it's very sweet. Not as sweet as the love story between George and David in the Time Machine movie, but also very sweet.
There's a book we learned about named Tau Zero by Paul Anderson, I think, which uses a similar device where you can go to the end of time and look back.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to me that it took, you know, Futurama riffs on so many different science fiction things. Yeah. This is an episode in season 7. It took them till season 7 to riff on Time Machine. So which is interesting to me. I couldn't believe they didn't do it sooner because they've done everything else.
Yeah, I don't know. I would have to go rewatch all the Futurama and see what they riffed on. I know they stole a whole bunch of stuff from Lem of all
things. They do steal a lot of things from Lem, yes. So. Okay, so that was Time Machine the book, Time Machine the movie, and the Futurama episode about Time Machine. I hope everyone had a good time listening to us. Do you get it? But so what's the plan? Next time.
So the plan for next time, we'll read All You Zombies, the short story, and watch the movie Predestination. That is loosely based on that one. And this is crazy super duper time knots.
Yay. More mental gymnastics. Woo. Right. That'll be great.
All right.
Anything else?
Nope.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on History in Reverse. My name is Caroline and I was here with Richie. And
hello and goodbye.
And goodbye, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
So what do you want me to say? Like, welcome
it's
to the
recording.
Outtakes?
No. Yeah, welcome to the outtakes.
These are the outtakes. We did not forget to edit. These are the outtakes. This is your Easter egg. Congratulations for listening.
Do you know what we're going to do next? Do you want, so here, I have an option for you. Do you want to read a book by a woman author with a woman main character?
Mm-hmm.
But there is no movie.
Okay.
Or do you want to read a short story and a movie? The short story is All You Zombies, and the movie's Predestination, which we saw once, and I wouldn't say the main character is a man or a woman because it's both.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a totally insane time loop story by Heinlein, I think. It was written like in one day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie was made in 2014. It was quite good. So we can do that. Oh. It's less reading and more movie watching.